Welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. Well, one of my favorite professors, UNC Chapel Hill's Jody Magnus, is our visitor, and she's just back from from the latest in a series of summer adventures in archaeology in the Holy Land. I guess, is that what we should say?
Probably the least offensive term.
At least I'm looking for a non-controversial term. On an archaeological project that started out to be simply trying to get a look at a 5th century A.D. A synagogue in a small town and has blossomed into something beautiful. Jody, how did you get involved in this? And then give us a report on the latest. You've come back from your summer archaeological digs.
Right. Well, thank you for having me back. And I always like, you know, every archaeologist likes to talk about their dig. So it's a treat to be able
to
do
digs.
This. Yeah, that's right. I started this project in 2011. So we have just finished our 7th season of excavations. It's at a site called Hukoke, which is spelled H-U-Q-O-Q. If your listeners are interested, we do have a website, which is simply www.hukoke.org, so they can look it up.
Or Google. Just Google Hukoke, and you'll get a whole bunch of stuff.
That's right. Or go to the UNC website and put Hukoke in, and you'll find it as well. So I've been digging there now for 7 seasons. I conduct this dig as a field school for UNC students and also students from other universities for academic credit. We offer it through UNC Study Abroad, so it's a really wonderful opportunity for UNC students to get experience in archaeology, visit another country, and fulfill some of their requirements along the way. And we always have a great group of students. And every summer I come back and I say, that was the best group of students that we've ever had. And
it's always the best.
And it's actually this summer.
And the others,
summer,
the others behind don't get jealous because you think that latest one.
Well, actually, a lot of the students, once they participate, they come back then every summer. So a lot of the students that we have are students who have been with us every summer for however many summers it's been. I actually have one student who started with us in 2011 when she was just finishing her first year of undergraduate at UNC. And in the meantime, she graduated, did a master's degree at Yale, came back, and is now my PhD student at UNC. And she's been with us every summer.
She's come every summer. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Well, let me, I promise you I wouldn't interrupt you, and so I'll break the promise for the first time, and there'll be many other times. But people listening in Chapel Hill are going to say to themselves, I wonder if I could do that. Could a 70 plus guy sign up for the course and go, or would you say yes? It's too stressful for you.
No, the problem actually isn't whether it's too stressful or not. It's because
overloaded.
No, that's not it either. Yeah. I do run it as a field school for students, so I do prefer to keep the emphasis on student participation. So it is possible for people who are not students to participate, but I make it difficult for them to do this. So, for example, they have to pay more than the students do to help sort of fund the dig, and they also have to commit to coming for the entire month.
Can't just come in and out and treat it as a vacation.
And by the way, all the students also have to come for the entire month. We do not do this as kind of a part-time thing. So it's a whole group for the entire month. And therefore, if people really are interested in supporting us, again, they can go to the website. There is a tab for, you know, how to get involved. But what we really need is financial support, funding, especially because once students have participated in that first year for academic credit and they want to come back and participate again, I almost always end up subsidizing and sometimes even completely covering their costs to come back because they can't get funding once they come back from the usual sources. So it really is a good cause. If people do want to support us, that's really the best way to do it.
What you're saying in a nice way is it's not set up for you, but you can bribe your way into it. If you're willing to work, then you'll pay.
I will actually give you an example. So we have one stalwart, my next door neighbor in Chapel Hill, who is a toxicologist, who came and worked with us a few summers ago and now has been completely bitten by the archaeology bug and comes back under the, you know, those strict circumstances every summer. He pays the full fee. He participates for the entire month. And so, you know, we do occasionally get these people, but usually there's not more than maybe two or three of them in any given summer.
Well, I think that's a great message, and I bet you there are hundreds of people who will hear this who will think about doing this, and maybe one or two would come to you and beg to be put on, and you would, if you're willing to pay and you're willing to work the whole month.
That's right.
And then we'll talk to you.
And if not, again, we can certainly use the financial support, but also there are other excavation projects that will accept volunteers under
and
less strict circumstances, and I'd be happy to advise people on that.
Now, second interruption, second broken promise. I'm continue to be amazed at how many people come to me with memories of the archaeological work and participation that they did as summer students 50 years ago or 60 years ago with Dr. Boyd.
That's right.
And since I live in his house, they come to me with, oh, yes, I had one of the best summers. And I know that the work is totally different, but nevertheless, it's something just that connects you to the past. And then I'm sure that the participation together as a group that builds a kind of spirit that services you for a lifetime.
Well, I've heard all about Professor Boyd since I'm in the religious studies department. I never met him. He was gone long before I arrived at UNC, but he is legendary. And I, too, run into people all the time who tell me about him. So I can only imagine how wonderful he was. But the work on the excavations is actually pretty much the same as it was in his time. I mean, it's really physical labor. It's, you know, just what you think, digging, you know, sifting. It's actually hard physical labor. Some of it has been changed a little by technology. So now, you know, a lot of recording is done with technology and stuff like that. But the actual work is really pretty much the same.
You know, I think of it without having done it, but I think of, you know, hard work for weeks and weeks and nothing comes up. And then all of a sudden, maybe there'll be a little piece of tile that you see that comes up.
Actually, you pretty much start finding. And I mean, again, it's going to vary depending on the site and depending on the country. But in archaeological sites in Israel, pretty much you just start scraping the surface and you're going to start finding pottery and, you know, pieces of pottery and bits of glass and, you know, animal bones, ancient animal bones, and all sorts of other stuff. So it's pretty much from the first spade that you put into the ground, you're going to start finding things.
Well, tell us about the extraordinary things.
Yeah. So going back to your original question. So the site, I started digging there in 2011. It is an ancient village very close to the Sea of Galilee, actually just a couple of miles away from Capernaum, which was, of course, the base of Jesus's Galilean ministry, and only a couple of miles away from ancient Migdal or Magdala, which was the hometown of Mary Magdalene. It was a Jewish village in antiquity. So in the time of Jesus and in the centuries after Jesus, it was a Jewish village. And in the 5th century AD, the Jewish villagers built an amazing synagogue building, a monumental synagogue building, which we have been uncovering since 2011. I originally started the excavations because I wanted to excavate a synagogue building. I was hoping to find a synagogue building of this particular architectural layout and type. It's a big rectangular building. But what I was not expecting to find were mosaics.
What were you looking for? Why did you want a 5th century?
Right. Well, so this is kind of gets into a technical, you know, academic thing.
I've heard you do this succinctly.
Yes, I'll try to do it succinctly. So archaeologists have grouped ancient synagogue buildings, by which I mean Roman period, so basically 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th century synagogue buildings, AD, of course, into a series of architectural types according to their layout and their decoration. And I think that some of these buildings are misdated by archaeologists. I think that some of them are dated too early. And the controversy focuses on one particular kind of synagogue building. It's called a Galilean-type synagogue, which is a big rectangular building with a basilical layout. It's laid out like a basilica, which means that the interior has a row of columns wrapping around it, creating a big central space, and narrower spaces around the sides. The central space is called a nave, and the narrower areas around the sides are called aisles. And the best...
Jody, it sounds like a church. Sounds
it
like
does.
A
It does. That's right. Yes. And so, and there is a lot of similarities between contemporary synagogues and churches. Basically, Jews and Christians were laying out their congregational halls of worship and prayer in very much the same way. And so you're exactly right about that. So at any rate, I believe that these Galilean-type synagogues in particular have been dated too early by many of my colleagues. Traditionally, they're dated on the basis of their architecture and style to the 2nd and 3rd centuries. I think they date to the 5th and 6th centuries. My goal originally was to find and excavate half of a synagogue of this type. I wanted to leave the other half intact so that if in the future other archaeologists wanted to check my results, if they wanted to say, well, you know, Jody Magnus misdated her building, there'd be something left for them to check. The problem was the minute that we found our first mosaics, which was in 2011, I realized that we now had to excavate the entire building because if I left half unexcavated, somebody else would then come in immediately and excavate to find more mosaics. So
not going to let them do that. They can prove their point, but
well,
we don't want to give them the mosaics.
Well, no, that's right. Well, no, it wasn't that. It was that it would just defeat the purpose. So the purpose was not so that somebody would come in the next day or the next year and excavate the rest of it, but to leave it for another, let's say, 10, 20, 30, 40 years when archaeological methodology has become more precise, because it does become more precise, like all the science all the time. And I knew that that would not happen if I left the half of it unexcavated. So it wasn't so that another archaeologist couldn't snatch the rest of the mosaics. It was because there simply would be no purpose in leaving half of it unexcavated.
Did you prove your point?
Well, I did, but that doesn't mean that I persuaded my colleagues. So, I mean, what I think I have demonstrated now is that this synagogue building dates to the early 5th century. We have good dating evidence. We have pottery and coins from under the floors and in the foundations of the building. We have radiocarbon dating of charcoal from the bedding of the mosaics, and they're all giving the same date, early 5th century. So I think that what I've proven is this building dates to the early 5th century. What I have not demonstrated is that all other synagogues of this type necessarily date to a later date. But what it does mean, I think, is that you can't automatically date all synagogues of this type then to the 2nd, 3rd centuries based on stylistic considerations.
I remember, we just got a minute before the break, but I remember that this was important because there's a dispute historically as to whether or not Jews could build synagogues in this time period.
That's absolutely right. So if we then assume that these synagogues date to, let's say, the 5th and 6th centuries instead of the 2nd and 3rd centuries, that puts them in a whole different historical context. So instead of being built when Jews were under pagan Roman rule, they were being built when Jews were under Byzantine Christian rule. And from the sort of modern historical point of view, that's been seen as a period when Jews were kind of oppressed by the Christians. The Christians were passing legislation that was trying to restrict the spread of Judaism.
Put everybody else out of business.
And so it shows, in fact, that these Jewish congregations continued to flourish under Byzantine Christian rule rather than being in
decline. So we're going to talk about the tiles, but you're also in the business of rewriting history.
Well, I don't know rewriting, but at least maybe rewriting. I mean, I think this is where, and I don't know if you want to go to break before we get into this, but it gets into sort of the sort of similarities or overlap and differences between history and archaeology, right? What is history and what is archaeology?
We better save that one.
Yes.
Let's take a break. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Professor Jody Magnus. We're talking about her archaeological projects, and in particular, we're here to talk about the recent finds, and we'll get to that after this short break. Welcome Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Jody Magnus. We're talking about her fantastic career as an archaeologist. And Jody, before we took the break, you said I'd ask a question about your changing history. And you said, well, let me tell you the difference between his or the association between history and archaeology. And so let's do that.
Yeah. So it's interesting because when I interviewed for my position here at UNC, my colleagues who are religious studies specialists, not archaeologists, at least a couple of them were trying to insist in the interview that I am an historian. And I kept saying, no, I'm an archaeologist. And they kept saying, no, but that's a historian. So I want to clarify, because people don't really understand this. The similarity is that both historians and archaeologists study the past. We're interested in learning about the past. The difference is how we get our information about the past. So historians learn about the past through literary sources, written documents. And the good thing about that is, because you can read a document and you can understand what it says. So that's pretty easy to do, sort of, you would think. The problem with studying the past through literary sources is that, like all literary sources, they have biases. So whoever wrote them was presenting that information from their particular background, perspective, point of view. And the people who generally wrote the historical sources that we have tended to be the elites, the upper classes of antiquity, and pretty much only men. So we learn about the past from history from the viewpoint of, you know, upper class men. Archaeologists learn about the past, but we do it by digging up human material culture. Now, what I mean by this is anything that humans, people, manufactured and left behind. So, for example, archaeologists do not study dinosaurs. We do not study bones. There are people who specialize in those fields, but that's not what archaeologists do. Archaeologists dig up human material culture, anything that humans manufactured and left behind. So houses, tombs, pottery, coins, whatever. We study that. We also do study everything else that we dig up, but those are specialties who do it. So people who specialize in animal bones are called in to do the animal bones or whatever. And we take all of that material that we've dug up and we use it to learn about the past. Now, the good thing about this is that we get a more complete picture of the past, because we're not learning only about, you know, upper class men necessarily. We're learning about the lives of everybody who lived in the past. So that's the good thing. The bad thing about archaeology, I shouldn't say the bad thing, I should say the limitations of archaeology is that archaeological information gives you certain types of information, but not others. So we might be able to say, for example, that the people of my village built a synagogue, but we won't necessarily be able to say why they built the synagogue, where they got the money from to build the synagogue, or what the images that decorate the mosaics meant to them, right? So archaeology gives us certain types of information, but it doesn't give us certain other types of information. You might learn from a literary source what the author thought about the images in the mosaic. So if we had a literary source, which we don't, but if we had somebody who had written about the Hukoke Synagogue and described the mosaics, they might tell us what they thought the mosaics meant to them. But we don't get that information from archaeology. So in other words, archaeological information and historical information can and should be used together to understand the past as complementing each other. So they're both interested in the study of the past, but they are, in fact, different disciplines which should be used mm-hmm. together. So that's that.
All right, but archaeology can change rendering of history.
Absolutely. And so that's actually one of the amazing things about my synagogue and other synagogues of this period, which is that before these synagogues came to light, we had no idea that Jews built synagogues decorated with these sorts of images. People thought that ancient Judaism was aniconic, that Jews did not decorate their synagogues with figured images in art. In fact, people thought that Jewish art was completely aniconic, that it had no figured images at all. So now, but thanks to archaeology, our picture of early Judaism and the larger context of early Judaism has changed, in fact, not just because of my dig, but because of archaeological discoveries in general. So absolutely.
Now, you're interested in archaeology, and you're also respected throughout the world as an archaeologist, and some of that has come to put a burden on you this year. You're the president
Yeah. This year I became the president of the Archaeological Institute of America, which is the AIA, which is the largest and oldest archaeological organization in North America. If your listeners are interested, the website is archaeological.org. And some of your listeners might actually be familiar with us through one of our publications, which is Archaeology Magazine, which is sort of a popular magazine. You see it a lot if you travel, for example. You might see it in newsstands. Maybe some of your listeners subscribe to it. And I would encourage anybody who's listening who's interested in archaeology to go to the website and join us. There are also special rates for students and young people. It's a wonderful way to sort of become familiar with archaeology and to become engaged in it. The Archaeological Institute of America also has something that's unique to other professional organizations. We have what are called local societies. So all around North America, we have societies that are based in different states and different places within states that sponsor activities, sponsor lectures for the general public. And we have a local society here, as a matter of fact, in the area of Chapel Hill. It sort of moves between Duke and UNC. And once you join the Archaeological Institute of America, you can also become a member of your local society.
You have to join the big group.
And there's, again, if you go to the website, you'll see information on how to become a member of your local society.
Can I do it for $25 or is it $50?
I don't recall what the rates are for the different categories. But if again you go online, you'll see the various rates and information. No, it's actually extremely
reasonable. And how often does the local group meet?
The number of lectures that each local society has varies depending on the local society, but it's usually somewhere around, let's say, a minimum of 4 to 6 lectures per year, usually during the course of the academic year, so between, let's say, September and May. And sometimes local societies host other activities as well. So please do look it up.
That's great. Now, is the role of the president mostly just to honor you as being a lead?
Oh, no, absolutely not. So, let me clarify, I'm not president of the local society. So each local society has their own president. I'm president of the national organization, and it's a 3-year term, and it actually is real work. It's not
like, what do you have to do?
Oh, it is.
I mean, you got a staff.
Well, the office is in Boston, so we have a permanent staff in Boston. There's also a New York office for Archaeology Magazine, and I sort of am the big kind of person who oversees all of this stuff. With there's like tons of committees, and it's a lot of work.
And does it compromise your work both on the summer digs and also your teaching? Do you get some relief from your teaching?
It doesn't compromise isn't the right word, right? So you have to kind of do it all. But I will say that, so I've been on leave now. I was on leave last year, and I'm on leave this fall, thank goodness. I became president in January. So for my first year of my presidency, I am on leave, and that has been a huge help. Once I go back to teaching in next spring, I will be back to my regular teaching load. I am not getting a course load reduction for being president of the AIA. So that's going to be a challenge.
Well,
but my department is, I think, going to be very helpful in accommodating me.
Well, you're very positive and supportive. Now, let's take a break and then come back and talk about the digs and what you found. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Professor Jody Magnus. We're talking about a lot of things about archaeology. We'll continue that conversation after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Professor Jody Magnus. We're talking about her archaeological interest and career, and we came to focus on the discoveries that you and your colleagues and your students have made in Hukuk, in Palestine, over the last 7 years.
Yes.
And I'm familiar with – well, first of all, tell us what's going on.
Well, so let me describe the synagogue, and then I'll tell you about what we found. So the synagogue is a big rectangular structure. It measures 20.
Let me just again interrupt you. For anybody who joined us late, which you probably have, this is a synagogue in a village in Galilee, which is important for Christians and for many others in terms of the region. But it's a Jewish synagogue from the 5th century that you were excavating.
That's right, yes. Thank you. So the synagogue is a big rectangular building. It measures 20 meters. A meter is about a yard. So it measures 20 meters long by 15 meters wide. So it's very big. And it is divided in the interior by a row of columns, or I should say really three rows of columns, that wrap around in the shape of the Greek letter pi. So the synagogue is oriented north-south, so the entrances were in the south wall, which is the wall that faces Jerusalem when you're in Galilee. And when you entered into a big central space called the nave, and then you had rows of columns wrapping around you on three sides. And on the other sides of the columns are narrower spaces that are called aisles, which encircle the nave from three sides. So trying to hopefully imagine what the building looks like. So when we first started digging in 2011, we came down on the east wall of the synagogue, so one of the two long walls, and we started then excavating the interior the following year in 2012, and we came down onto the synagogue floor. And for the first, let's say, five seasons, we pretty much confined ourselves to the east aisle, so the sort of narrow aisle that runs along the eastern interior side of the synagogue, and exposed successively the mosaics that paved that aisle.
Was this a surprise for you to
complete
find mosaics? Why was it a surprise to you? You didn't go looking for mosaics.
Correct. I was not looking for mosaics, not expecting mosaics. The reason it was a surprise is because this particular kind of synagogue building, what's called a Galilean-type synagogue, usually doesn't have mosaic floors. Usually they're paved with flagstones, so just, you know, stone pavement inside and not mosaics. So the discovery of mosaics was a complete surprise. And there are many very interesting things about our mosaics, but what most people are interested in are what the mosaics show. So what we have discovered over the course of time is that that the synagogue is decorated with a series of panels. And each panel shows a scene of something, and all but one of the panels, well, that's not correct. Nearly all of the panels that we have uncovered so far contain biblical stories, scenes showing biblical stories. And so we, in the first five seasons, pretty much confined ourselves to the East Aisle. The last two summers, so last summer and this summer, we uncovered the nave. So last summer we did the northern half of the nave, which again is the central part of the hall. And this summer we did the southern half of the nave. And the mosaics are just, they're extraordinary. First of all, they're extraordinary to look at, but also the content is, for the most part, unparalleled.
Well, why were you surprised to find it? Is it, there have been other synagogues excavated, didn't they have mosaics too?
And so, yeah, there are other synagogue types that have synagogues that have mosaics, but this particular type of synagogue building, this Galilean type, which is this big rectangular basilical type, usually doesn't have mosaic floors. The best example of a synagogue of this type is the one at Capernaum, which is just a couple of miles away, which maybe some of your listeners have visited. And if you go there, you'll see it just has flagstone pavement inside. So
very similar to the synagogue in Hukok, but in
very similar, in a teeny bit bigger. Theirs is 22 meters long,
and ours
is very similar. So if you want to get a good idea of what our synagogue looked like, you could just go and look.
So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, and you're thinking, oh, this synagogue in Capernaum, it's been reconstructed. It's great. I'm just going to be doing a little synagogue in a nearby town of poor people, and it's not going to be very much. And then all of a sudden,
yeah,
come on these.
Yeah, and then we come on, yes, the mother
and
of all
synagogues. Is that good news or bad news for you?
So if I say it was bad news, I'm going to sound whiny, and I don't want to sound whiny. So, I mean, look, overall, it's great. I mean, it's, you know, almost none of my colleagues have ever found anything like this. I never expected to find anything like this. It's the kind of discovery that, you know, this makes your reputation
forever. This makes you famous.
Yeah,
this makes you famous forever.
It's an extraordinary blessing to be able to, you know, find and excavate something like this. It's also an extraordinary responsibility to find and excavate something like this, a big challenge in many ways, which we can talk about. The reason I want to say, I don't want to sound whiny, but what I do want to say is, you know, look, I've spent a lifetime working in archaeology, and my goal was not to find something that made me famous. My goal was not to have something splashy and sensational. And I sort of feel like, and I felt like this earlier on, now I've kind of gotten used to the mosaics, but I felt early on like I spent a lifetime working very hard at very careful research, which didn't really get necessarily much attention, which is fine. And then suddenly I make this amazing but very, you know, serendipity chance discovery, and suddenly I'm famous. So, I mean, I really think that as a scholar and as a scientist, which I consider myself to be, my reputation and my fame should be based on the corpus of my and the quality of my work over the course of my career, and not necessarily because I happen to make a chance splashy sensational find. That's the whiny part.
That's the whiny part. Sort of like, I won the lottery and it was the worst thing that ever happened to me.
No, it's not. So I don't want to complain like that because it really is amazing. And you know, it's led to all sorts of unexpected things. But I just want to say that I do think that I would like people to value the meticulous work that you know, all of us as archaeologists and as scholars do, that doesn't necessarily result in a big splashy find like this, right? That's sort of what I
want you to let's take a break, and then I want you to tell us specifically what some of the mosaics show. And the mosaics, I guess I've tried to think, the mosaics are like stained glass windows in many churches in the sense that they tell.
Yes,
they tell
stories,
but you look down on them rather than looking out. Anyway, let's stop talking for just a second, and then we'll come back, and J.D. Magnus will tell us, try to describe some of the exciting scenes that she's found on the mosaics, which have changed her life. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Professor Jody Magnus. She's just returned, or recently returned, from her regular month-long summer digs at Houkouk, where she is uncovering on a lifetime project, maybe, but for the last 7 years. And every year, Jody, you something new and wonderful pops
year.
Up.
So, before I tell you about the mosaics that we have, let me just say for the benefit of your listeners that if they go to our website, Houkouk, Houkouk.org, they will be able to find links to media coverage, to images of the mosaics that have been posted. Let me point out that many of the mosaics have not yet been published, or in some cases we've released only very small parts of the overall mosaic because we're in the process of publishing them. And so we don't release the images until we've had a chance to
publish National Geographic
them.
Has already published some of yours.
Yeah,
You think maybe they might do more.
Well, it's possible. National Geographic does help fund our dig, but then they work on their own schedule. So what they will eventually do with the images that they photographed
is enough online to be excited.
That's right. And people will find the links. So as I mentioned in the previous segment, most of the mosaics that we've uncovered are panels that depict biblical stories. We have specifically so far two panels that depict scenes of Samson, the biblical hero Samson. The very first one that we found in 2012 was Samson and the Foxes, which is from Judges 15, the book of Judges 15, where Samson takes revenge on the Philistines by taking 300 foxes. He puts them in pairs. He ties their tails together. He puts lighted torches between their tails and then sets them loose to burn down the agricultural fields of the Philistines. So we have a mosaic where you can see a pair of foxes with their tails tied together in a lighted torch and part of Samson's body next to them. The following summer, we found our second Samson scene, which is Samson and the Gate of Gaza. That's from Judges 16, where Samson goes to Gaza to sleep with a prostitute. And during the night, the people of Gaza decide they're going to ambush him when he comes out in the morning, but he fools them and he gets up in the middle of the night and he goes over and he pulls up the Gate of Gaza and he puts the whole thing on his shoulders and then he walks away and carries it towards Hebron, and you see Samson with the Gate of Gaza on his shoulders. That mosaic is available. You can see it online. We have more biblical stories. Last summer in the nave, we discovered a scene of Noah and the Ark, and the part that's preserved shows dozens of pairs of animals, all different kinds of animals in pairs. So we have elephants and snakes and leopards and donkeys and you name it, ostriches, all different pairs of animals. And we have a little bit of the ark, but unfortunately most of it and all of Noah are gone because of later damage to the mosaic. We also have from last summer a scene of the parting of the Red Sea, or more accurately, Pharaoh's soldiers being swallowed up by the Red Sea, or even more accurately, what we have are giant fish in the Red Sea swallowing Pharaoh's soldiers. It's really weird. You see, like, the soldiers halfway down the gullets of the fish. Very strange. And then this summer, we found more biblical scenes. So we found this summer the story of Jonah and the whale, which is actually the first time that it's ever been discovered decorating a Jewish building. Jonah was a popular story decorating early Christian art in churches, but so far not in synagogues. So this is the first time we have it in a synagogue. And it's a really interesting version of the Jonah story because it shows three successive fish swallowing Jonah. You see Jonah's legs dangling out of the mouth of a fish, and then there's a bigger fish that's swallowing that fish and a bigger fish that's swallowing that fish, which is a really interesting variation on the Jonah story. Both of that, by the way, and the Red Sea are what are called midrashim, which are Jewish elaborations on biblical stories. So there was a custom among Jews to take biblical stories and then to elaborate
on them. Make them better.
And that's right. And so these are both midrashim. And then we also have this summer an amazing scene showing the building of the Tower of Babel. And it's the tower is being built by all of these different workmen figures who are working on stone and working in wood and doing all sorts of different activities. It's almost like an instruction in ancient technology, how to build things in ancient times. And there's a pulley system to pull up the stones to the tower. It's amazing. It's absolutely an amazing scene. We did release one small image from that this summer, which shows one of the workmen who's
working. So that's all we can see of that, right?
That's all
you're holding back on us.
We're holding back. It's only fair to give the specialists on my team time to publish it properly before we release it, because once it's out, anybody could then publish and write about it. And it's only fair to my team, who have invested so much time and effort with us in the field, to give them that time that they need. So we have those. We have two more amazing scenes in our mosaics. One we discovered this summer. It's a Helios and Zodiac cycle. This is something that has been found in other ancient synagogues in Israel. In the center panel or the center medallion, you see Helios, the Greco-Roman sun god, being pulled in a chariot by horses across the sky.
Well, what is this doing in a chariot?
I know.
You let the historians tell us.
That you have to invite me back, because that's a whole other story. That is surrounded by the signs of the Zodiac, but in our synagogue, there's a little bit of a variation. You have the signs of the Zodiac surrounding, but each sign of the Zodiac is actually accompanied by a personification of the month that goes with the Zodiac, and then they're labeled in Hebrew with the name of the month. And then in the four corners of that panel are personifications of the seasons labeled with their names.
This is the Greek calendar rather than the Jewish calendar.
Well, not exactly.
We'll do that next time.
Yeah.
We'll do that next time.
And there's probably been more scholarly ink spilled on Helio-Zodiac cycles in synagogues than on any other thing in ancient synagogues. So there's reams and reams, including a huge article that I published in 2005. So there's a lot of controversy about what this particular panel means. And then over the course of three seasons in 2013, 2014, and 2015, we uncovered what we call the elephant mosaic, which is an amazing panel that shows what's apparently the first non-biblical story ever discovered in an ancient synagogue. It culminates with a meeting between a person who's depicted as a Greek ruler and military commander and apparently an elderly Jewish man, probably a high priestly figure. I think it's the legendary meeting between Alexander the Great and the Jewish high priest. My staff specialists who are publishing this mosaic have a different interpretation. Actually, every person who has seen this mosaic has a different interpretation of it. We are now moving towards the final publication of this mosaic.
Can we see this one on your website?
No, this is the one that actually had been posted by National Geographic, but we had to take it down because somebody then tried to illegally publish a scholarly article about it, so we had to ask National Geographic to remove it from the internet. it. So it's now down, but the article, the scholarly article by my specialist, is supposed to appear in print in October. And once it's out, then it will be reposted. The National Geographic
image will be
reposted. That's right. And it will be out and accessible, and people will be able to, you know, see it and discuss it and write about it.
Well, now, are you through?
That's the main thing.
Yeah. I mean, but next summer, is there a possibility that you'll uncover more mosaics?
No, we're not done. We anticipate that we have at least another 4 to 5 seasons. We have not yet excavated the North Aisle or the West Aisle.
So there's more to come.
Oh, well, yeah, I expect so, yes.
What, in a word, because we're out of time, but what, as you pointed out earlier, discovering the tiles is complicated because it takes the focus off of some of the, what have we missed by focusing on the tiles?
Well, yeah. Oh, boy. That would be a whole other conversation.
Well, just in a minute.
In 1 minute, let me say that we have a very interesting reuse of the original synagogue building. Apparently, in the Middle Ages, it was rebuilt. They laid a new floor above, about a meter above the original floor, and expanded the size of the building so it's even bigger. And we think that later building is also a synagogue. It also was paved with mosaics, but they're hardly preserved at all. And if it is a medieval synagogue building, then it would be unique. In fact, it would probably be more important than the original synagogue building.
Will you come back sometime soon?
I'd love to.
And talk to us. Jodi Magnus has been our guest and got me and probably you too excited about her work and the work of her students and colleagues at HUCOC. If you did join us late, Google HUCOC, Google UNC Chapel Hill and Jodi Magnus, and you can get a link to extraordinary pictures of the tiles that she's described. The mosaics that she's described. Thanks, Jodi.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.